You're listening to event audio from the Brookings Events Podcast, part of the Brookings Podcast Network. For more in-depth analysis and commentary from Brookings scholars and our guests, go to brookings.edu/podcasts or subscribe to Brookings Podcasts through iTunes or your favorite podcast app. You can also follow us on Twitter at @policypodcasts.
Good afternoon, everyone. My name is Mireya Solis. I'm Senior Fellow and Night Chair in Japan Studies at Brookings. And it's a pleasure to welcome you this afternoon. We have a program on development lending in Asia Pacific. And I have to say, I really appreciate to see a room full of people when we have a steamy day in DC. So thank you very much for agreeing to come on such a hot day. So you're all aware that the development lending needs in the Asia Pacific region are substantial. And it's not only in terms of infrastructure, but also in order to address the tasks of poverty reduction, climate resilience, and to meet the other very pressing sustainable development goals. The Asia-Pacific region is also home to the three largest economies in the world, all of whom have played leadership roles in supporting multilateral development banks, such as the World Bank, the Asia Development Bank, and the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank. And each donor, I should say, has distinct views on the role that development lending should play in this region. So the purpose of today's program is to discuss how established and emerging powers in the region are defining the role of development finance. And to that end, the panelists today will address a number of very important questions. For example, which areas should each development bank emphasize to maximize the effectiveness of its lending? How has the institutional proliferation with the newest arrival, the AIB, affected the division of labor among development banks, and what is the scope for collaboration? And what will be the implications for the region if the Trump administration's proposed cuts to contributions to multilateral development banks and economic assistance do materialize? What role should Japan and China, for example, play if there is a diminished role for the United States? So we have an excellent group of panelists, of experts, to help us understand the many issues at stake. And let me introduce them briefly in the order in which I'll ask them to come to the podium and give their brief remarks before we all come to the stage and engage in a conversation and then bring all of you with questions and answers. So first we have Victoria Kwakwa, who is Vice President for the East Asia and Pacific region at the World Bank, where she oversees a portfolio of loans, grants, credits, and trust funds that covers 23 countries. Prior to this position, Ms. Kwakwa was the World Bank's country director for Vietnam and country manager for Rwanda. Miles Kaler is distinguished professor with the School of International Service at American University and senior fellow for global governance at the Council of Foreign Relations. His current research centers on the role of emerging economies in global governance, and he has recently co-edited two books, Integrating Regions, Asia in Comparative Context, and Politics in the New Hard Times. Next, we have Scott Morris, who is a senior fellow at the Center for Global Development and director of the U.S. Development Policy Initiative, which seeks to broaden the U.S. government approach to development. Mr. Morris served as Deputy Assistant Secretary for Development Finance and Debt at the U.S. Treasury Department during the first term of the Obama administration. In that capacity, he led the U.S. engagement with multilateral development banks. Hongying Wang is Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Waterloo. She teaches courses on China and global governance and is the author of Weak State, Strong Networks, The Institutional Dynamics of Foreign Direct Investment in China, and co-editor of Enter the Dragon, China in the International Financial System. And last but not least, Hiroyuki Nakashima, who is a fellow with the Rebuild Japan Initiative Foundation, a Japanese think tank, and he also serves as the senior representative in DC for the Japan Bank for International Cooperation. So without further ado, Ms. Kwakwa, if you could please come to the stage. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon. In my brief remarks, I'll give a context of the region, the latest issues, and then talk about what the World Bank is doing in East Asia and the Pacific, and just give some thoughts on the opportunities and challenges for development lending and work between the growing number of multilateral development banks in the region. Let me thank you for inviting me to be part of this very important panel. I think all of us here know that East Asia is a very successful region. It's had spectacular development success. It's declined rates of poverty faster than any other region, going from about 50% to 3% in 2015, and that's extreme poverty, using the dollar a day poverty line. We also know that the incomes of the bottom 40% of the populations has been growing faster than the rest of the population. We know, however, that this is not a finished agenda. There's still tens of millions of poor people, including even in countries such as China, countries such as Vietnam. In Laos, PDR, Timor-Leste, and PNG, poverty numbers are much higher, 30 to 40%. And then we also know that there's increasing inequality in countries like Indonesia and Philippines in particular, and inequality levels, income inequality levels are generally high in the region. And even when poverty, people have been pulled out of poverty, several hundreds of millions still hover around the poverty line and are vulnerable to falling back into poverty. Inequality of access to opportunity, to social services is really a major issue and is a key driver of income inequality, which is increasing. We also know that the region continues to be very important for global growth. We've seen the region being a major contributor or driver of growth in the last decade or so. But the growth is also facing vulnerabilities, financial stress due to high levels of corporate and household debt, slower export growth because of slower global trade growth, and fundamental problems with productivity growth, you know, which is declining, such as is happening in several other countries globally. China is experiencing it, Vietnam, Indonesia, Thailand, etc., etc. So this productivity growth is really a major challenge for countries. They're looking at new models of growth that will be more productivity focused. A common driver of the productivity slowdown is infrastructure gaps, as our colleague just mentioned, which we estimate is in the order of about $50 billion annually, not even including China. There are human capital constraints. This region has invested a lot in human capital that has driven part of their success. But going to the next level and generating in educational institutions the kinds of higher level skills that will drive productivity and drive the next wave of development is still a focus, is still a challenge. And one thing that a lot of people don't know that is that stunting levels are very high in this region, despite the success that's been made. And this has implications for future growth of the population and their ability to engage with new models of technology and the labor market that we see out there. Climate change, major issue, you're all aware of it. East Asia is one of the most vulnerable regions to climate. It also houses some of the largest emitters of greenhouse gas emissions. And so work on these issues is really important. So a very successful region, still significant problems, potential to continue to contribute to the global public good and global agenda. So in this regional context, what is the World Bank doing? And what are we hearing our clients tell us? And a lot of times when I think people talk about the World Bank, it's about lending. And that's what we're discussing this afternoon. But I want to highlight that in East Asia in particular, and even more broadly, our work is much, much more than lending. When we talk about China, for example, China comes to us not just for money, but because we bring a lot more to the table. They come to us about complex issues that they feel they cannot solve on their own, to innovate and to pilot ideas to solve specific problems, which then they take off and scale on their own to get more generalized impact. When we talk about Malaysia, we're doing a lot of what we call reimbursable advisory services, where they're asking us for knowledge and expertise, new ideas about problems that they need to solve. And we're doing similarly in Thailand. So the knowledge, innovation, new ideas around complex issues is very much a part of the work that we do. Evidence in some of the flagship reports that we've done on Healthy China, Vietnam 2035, etc., etc. There's also demand for South-South knowledge, learning from each other, China giving its own knowledge to others, other countries learning from China, etc. And the fact that we have countries like Korea, which have graduated from the World Bank lending, asking us to set up hubs with them, you know, where Korea's development experience is shared with other countries, is a signal of the sorts of engagements the clients are looking to us for. Similarly, in Singapore, where we have an infrastructure hub. And so very much the knowledge, innovation, new ideas. And then also a convening and coordinating role, whether it's convening people within national borders to discuss issues, to come to closure on policy reform agendas, whether it's helping to coordinate and convene at the regional level around regional issues, whether it's convening and helping to address issues that the region contributes to at a global level. In all of these, we're providing support to our clients. Increasingly also in the work that is happening in ASEAN. And we anticipate in the Belt and Road Initiative that we recently saw the summit of on, that the bank will be doing a lot more in this. And finally, financing. So I'm not saying financing is not important, but I wanted to say it's a lot more than financing. It's financing plus, but the financing is also important. And you see some of the numbers that we have here. For several of our countries, yes, they do have major financing constraints. Achieving the SDGs will take a lot of resources, meeting infrastructure gaps, etc., developing a new growth model, and so on. All of these are things that require financing, and for some, the financing constraints are really major. Our scale-up on IDA 18, which is really the IDA, as I'm sure several of you know, is a concessional arm of the bank, where we've just completed a very successful replenishment, and we're able to significantly grow our support to several of the IDA countries in the region, particularly in the Pacific, is going to be really important. Now, so in face of these client demands for our support, what are we doing? And our work is really around a couple of pillars. The private sector-led growth, I've mentioned helping the countries forge new models that will take them to the next level and help them continue to contribute to global growth. The inclusion agenda, which, as I've described, remains highly relevant. The hard-to-reach poverty, equality of opportunity, and also reforms to pensions and social security systems in view of the aging population in the region. On the climate agenda, both the adaptation in areas such as the Mekong Delta and the mitigation agenda as well, doing innovative things with China, with Indonesia on forest fires, and with Vietnam on solar, renewables, the energy transition, and so on and so forth. On governance, rising middle class in the region, more demands for better governance, accountability of governments, and stronger and improved service delivery, including at the local levels. These are all areas that we cover under the governance. So a couple of key areas or broad pillars that we support, and we recognize very much that we can't do it alone. So for us, we work very much through partnerships. Partnerships, even stronger partnerships within the World Bank Group. That's the World Bank, that's a public sector arm, IFC, the private sector arm, MIGA, that brings in guarantees and so on. So working together more synergistically as a World Bank Group to leverage fully the might of the World Bank and to bring more private financing to the table as public resources for development finance dry out or become less and less available. And then we're also working with other multilateral institutions, the new multilateral institutions that have been created, the NDB, the AIIB, working with them in strong partnerships that are leveraging their comparative advantage, they're leveraging our comparative advantage to bring to our clients, particularly have strong partnerships ongoing with the AIIB, where we've already co-financed operations with them on Indonesia, and we're looking at something coming up on the Philippines and other operations coming up in East Asia and even in other regions. Of the World Bank work. We have a co-financing framework agreement with AIIB that allows us to sort of take the lead in preparing the project and then co-finance, share the financing burden. And that is also helping really address some of the issues around our capital and capital constraints that we have. But it's not just the AIIB, it's the EIB as well. Of course, the ADB that we work with regularly. We have an MOU with a new development bank, you know, some operations being discussed, nothing achieved yet. And with several of our bilateral partners, we have trust funds that we're working on. And then just a couple of thoughts on, you know, opportunities and challenges of the new the growing number of multilateral development banks, you know, and I think that there are some opportunities. Because this is very consistent with the world as we see it these days, which is really a multipolar world, multipolar sources of growth and politics and political power and influence. And having more multilateral development banks is just a reflection of it. And it brings more development financing to the table in a context when a lot more is needed than so what some of the traditional sources can provide. And emerging powers have more of a chance to shape the global finance architecture and the development agenda and how it's financed. And I think this is really important. A greater choice for the developing countries in East Asia, the Pacific. You know, you don't only have to go to the World Bank. You do have some choices, which I think is good. There's an increased probability of being able to help countries achieve larger and more complex projects, which, let's say, with a World Bank alone, we wouldn't be able to do because there are some country constraints that might be breached, country lending constraints. So several partners coming together make it possible to do more complex and larger operations for our countries. And there's also a more risk and burden sharing between multiple players. And then there's also the possibility of MDBs developing their brands and maybe distinguishing themselves a little bit more. It's still early days yet, and I think we'll see some of this happening. What are some of the challenges? You know, somebody could argue that you could see a bit of a race to the bottom because all of us are going to be competing for the same business. I don't see this as a strong possibility at all, because I think there's just so much to do. And there's so much need for financing that this is not, in my view, I think it's a theoretical possibility, but highly unlikely. You could have an increase in requirements on the countries because AIIB has its own standards on environmental, social, procurement. We have ours, the ADB has theirs, NDB has theirs, and so on. What happens is that several of these guidelines are really similar. But then you see that most of us have the possibility in our rules to use the procedures and the requirements of others. So when AIIB works with us, it uses our standards, our environmental and social standards. We have similarly in our laws or our requirements that we can use another partner's standards and so on. So it doesn't have to really create these difficulties and additional burdens on the clients. But I think ultimately it's going to be about partnerships, and it's going to have to be about all of us recognizing that there's a lot of work to do still and partnering more closely to seize the opportunity and bring much more to the countries in Asia and the Pacific. Thank you.
Although I worked on the region for some time as a specialist in international political economy, I'm going to speak a little bit today more about the global level, because development lending in the Asia-Pacific is not simply a regional issue with regional implications. Given the scale of the prospective development lending that is envisioned on the part of China in particular, either through regional multilateral institutions such as the AIIB or bilateral initiatives such as the Belt and Road, and given the importance of the Asia-Pacific in the world economy, the future of development lending in the region will have global implications. In the eyes of the optimist, opportunities lie in the scale of potential lending, which will still not match the estimated needs of the region, particularly for infrastructure. More resources dedicated to infrastructure is, in the optimistic view, an unqualified good. Side benefit is that China may offer new models of development lending that are more efficient, less intrusive, and more compatible with the aims of those countries receiving the lending. New institutions and avenues for development lending may provide a beneficial division of labor among institutions as well as useful competition. And Dr. Kwakwa's remarks suggested the kind of division of labor that could emerge and the type of useful competition as well. But the challenges also require attention, and they lie in the outsized role that is likely to be played by China, particularly if the United States and institutions in which the United States plays a central role lean back and become less active at the same time that China is leaning forward. So challenge number one, fragmentation in the domain of development lending. It's a long-standing feature. Development lending has always had multiple actors, national aid agencies, NGOs, regional NBDs, DBs, and the World Bank, of course. They've been present for some time. Sometimes they coordinate and collaborate in ways that Dr. Kwakwa suggested, and sometimes they compete in ways that are not always that helpful. It seems to be of greater concern is whether the division of labor proposed by China, implicitly or explicitly, is a positive one. China will play a large and growing role in infrastructure lending. That is what China is interested in. But it will not play the same role in policy lending or the many other domains that Dr. Kwakwa has pointed out in which the World Bank has played a leading role, and other MDBs as well. There could also be fragmentation of a more destructive type because of geopolitical competition. India, in particular, has made clear its unhappiness with the Belt and Road Initiative, even though it is participating in the NDB and the AIIB. And that suggests at least further fragmentation in Asia infrastructure lending and possible political competition as well. Challenge number two is competition, which I've already mentioned is potentially useful, beneficial. In a Council on Foreign Relations project last year, we had a series of discussion papers across issue areas that made clear that competition between global and regional institutions could be either beneficial or destructive. If competition by the AIIB with other lenders becomes a competition over the norms of development lending, however, with a relaxation of environmental corruption and other safeguards on the part of China, then those standards are likely to be undermined as a result. And you've just heard Dr. Kwakwa suggest that that's an unlikely outcome, but I suspect other members of the panel may have a more mixed view of whether that is likely to take place. So fragmentation, competition. Challenge number three is the response by others to China's initiatives, because it seems to me much of the commentary on development lending in the last few years has been exclusively focused on the role of China and on the existing and its effects on the existing regime of development lending. And that is a skewed perspective, because the response of other lenders is also important and probably equally important. If you look at the regional level, it seems rather than competition, which I've mentioned could be possibly beneficial and possibly destructive at the global level with global institutions, At the regional level, it is China's possible dominant or monopoly position that is a concern, particularly in its bilateral initiatives such as the Belt and Road. China, in this more negative or pessimistic view, may aim to lock in patterns of economic dependence through infrastructure lending. Now, one way of avoiding such an outcome is for other lenders to include support for capacity building on the part of borrowers so that they can better evaluate the costs and benefits of particular infrastructure projects and better integrate them into their larger development goals. This is a task for other lenders who are concerned about the possible role that China might play. But more broadly, it seems to me, the other actors in the region, whether other bilateral lenders like the United States and Japan, other MDBs such as the Asia Development Bank, or global multilaterals like the World Bank, is to provide multiple outside options for the borrowers so that lock-in is less likely. That would mean direct engagement with China on its infrastructure plans, particularly its bilateral plans, which the Trump administration signaled by sending a small delegation to the Belt and Road Forum. Whether that concession to China was a good idea in the context of overall Sino-US relations is another matter that I leave aside. But most important, it means continued and strengthened support by the United States and other industrialized countries for global and regional alternatives, beginning with the World Bank. And unfortunately, on the US side, that is the least likely outcome given the political climate in the United States. And that leads me to my final point, which is if the United States does lean back and disengage and become less active, which certainly seems a likely prospect at the moment, can other actors, particularly other national governments or the European Union, Japan, including borrowing governments like India, can they pick up some of the roles, some of the energy, and some of the activism in at the global level in particular that will be left by the United States? And here, once again, discussions point in two possible directions. And we can see this conversation taking place across issue areas, from development lending to climate to trade with the United States' decision to leave the TPP. And here the question is, will the United States leaning back or taking a less active role energize other actors to play a more prominent role and a more active role, picking up the slack, if you will? Or will they decide that it's not worth their energy if the United States, such a major player, is no longer willing to play that role? And on that very central question, I would say the jury is still very much out. Thank you.
Well, thank you and good afternoon. It's really a pleasure to be on this excellent panel. I wish I could promise, having listened to Miles' excellent remarks, I wish I could promise a more combative stance toward a very similar set of remarks. I'll try, but I think certainly covering very similar ground, and I think the same set of what I see as important issues for broadly this topic of development finance in Asia, specifically infrastructure development finance, and then even more specifically the role of the multilateral development banks in the provision of infrastructure finance. So what I do want to get to are what strike me as two important and interesting questions. What's the U.S. going to do and what's China going to do? But both are, as you said, these are speculative. Any answers are speculative. I will go ahead and speculate, but let me start with a few facts that I'm on firmer ground. So the Asian Development Bank, and it's important to recognize this role, actually, of research and agenda setting. So the Asian Development Bank has a widely cited study on infrastructure needs in the region, identifying a need on the order of $1.7 trillion a year through 2030, $200 billion a year of that devoted specifically to climate change mitigation and adaptation. That compares to current levels of spending that are less than half of that $1.7 trillion a year. To look specifically at the role of the MDBs, they are financing about 2.5% of current infrastructure financing in the region. When you exclude China and India, that number does rise to 10%. That's quite a jump, actually, outside of those two large economies. Now, I think it's important to recognize, because so much of the agenda, particularly the MDB agenda these days, is consumed at least on the rhetorical side, but I think meaningfully on financing, it's so much defined about leveraging the private sector. I think it's always important to make a simple point that it remains the case that much of infrastructure financing is public financing. And because of the unique qualities of much of infrastructure, it will always be public financing. So when you look at the numbers and you outside of the telecoms, which are heavily privately financed, it is still the case that the major sectors of infrastructure are publicly financed. They are also in the region largely domestically financed, so that they are not predominantly financed by external sources, whether donors or multilaterals. And that does vary, actually. There are some exceptions, I think, within the region and low-income countries in the region that are heavily dependent on external sources of finance. But given all of these qualities, I think it is useful to recognize, despite that 2.5% number for the MDBs, that they do play a key role in this agenda that is belied by that particular figure. And it's both in recognizing that they are a source of public finance at favorable rates, actually, even though we call a lot of what they do market-based lending. But even more importantly, that financing comes, as we heard, with a package of support that is money alongside of technical support and focusing on different aspects of project development that cannot be obtained through other sources of financing. So it is worth this kind of topic today, why the MDBs in this agenda and what role they play in the region. So just a few more facts. So who are the leading MDBs in the region when it comes to infrastructure finance? So if we look at 2015, the ADB and the World Bank Group are essentially at the same levels of support. I think slightly different definitions of the region get you to different numbers than what we saw on the tables, but they're both providing about $10 billion a year in infrastructure finance. At the World Bank, $3 billion of that is through the IFC for private sector. And then third, it's useful to note, because it isn't often observed in Washington, the Islamic Development Bank is actually providing $3 billion a year in support in the region. And then, of course, where so much of the attention these days has been with the new actors, the New Development Bank, the AIIB, but they are new, and in terms of actual operations and financing, they are still quite small. About $1 billion in Asia for the New Development Bank so far, and the AIIB is up to $2 billion now, but an estimate of $1.7 billion in projects in 2016. Most of them co-financed with the World Bank, the ADB, the EBRD. So with that context, to get to the interesting questions, how will the U.S. act on this agenda and how will China act? So for the United States, it's important to recognize how critical the U.S. voice and influence is within what we can call at CGD, we call the legacy MDBs, but in contrast to these new players led by new actors, you have the World Bank, the ADB, and other regional banks that have been around a long time, and they all, almost without exception, have the United States as their largest shareholder or co-largest shareholder. And as a result, the U.S. wields a great deal of influence in those institutions, particularly when it comes to the sort of high-level questions that we can sort of call ambition. How big do we want these institutions to be? How active do we want them to be? The U.S. does essentially play a veto kind of role on these questions, looking at it on the negative side. And then in terms of expressing ambition, if the U.S. Decides to move, I think things tend to move pretty quickly for these institutions. So that's a critical point to recognize as we consider a question of should the World Bank have a capital increase from its shareholders? Should the ADB have a capital increase from its shareholders? It is important to recognize these days that alongside that question, which is sort of a traditional question, it's as long as we've had these institutions and their initial capitalization, every so many, well, essentially every decade you face this question of should the shareholders kick in more money on the capital side. But increasingly in recent years, you've also had this agenda that the G20 wants to call or does call balance sheet optimization, which is a range of measures that the banks can take short of asking for more capital that has the effect of enabling them to lend more. And they've actually, the institutions have actually been quite active on this agenda. And I think with the ADB really at the forefront in taking a pretty aggressive and bold move in some balance sheet measures a few years ago, that, you know, by the measure of impact, without describing any detail what they actually did, we can note that the measures have allowed them to go from what was this, about $14 billion a year in lending in 2014 up to eventually they will be able to do $20 billion a year by 2020. That's with essentially existing capital in the institution and no additional money from the shareholders. But it is also the case that demand for infrastructure finance continues to outpace the ability of the banks to meet that demand. And they are, particularly the legacy MDVs, are facing capital constraints these days, which is not preordained. And I think it is it's useful to think back prior to the global financial crisis that, in fact, there was much more of a discussion in Washington about what do we do in the face of declining demand for lending from these institutions. I don't think that's the picture at all today. I think whether it was the financial crisis itself or some other factors that has created a structural shift in how the borrowing countries view the institutions, and they are demanding more from them. So what's the Trump administration going to do in the face of this? We don't have much in the way of rhetoric that we can hang our hats on. We do have a budget request now. And if we look at the cuts that the MDBs face in this budget, it's useful to ask compared to what. Because certainly a cut on the order of, it's about 20% if you set aside the Green Climate Fund, the things that are strictly climate finance institutions, funding for the core MDBs is cut by about 20%. I tend to think that's disastrous in some respects. On the other hand, if you compare that to how the rest of the foreign assistance budget fares, with cuts on the order of 30%, all the way up to 100% in programs that would have otherwise been viewed as sacrosanct in the United States, somehow, in relative terms, the MDBs are doing pretty well. If you're trying to think about the signals that this administration is sending, add to that, and this is my attempt to present an optimistic view about where the U.S. is going. If you add to that what we know about the White House's interest in a new women's entrepreneur initiative that they're working through the G20 process, and which the World Bank is playing a leading role on in hosting a new facility, that engagement in particular, and then reports of engagements around how the World Bank, in fact, can provide the U.S. with some technical expertise on infrastructure finance, these are signs of some kind of relationship developing that one can imagine could lead to a firmer embrace of the institutions on the part of even this administration. That said, I think there's also very good reasons to expect, frankly, a more negative stance. Again, it is a 20% cut at the end of the day. And even more fundamentally, the fact is much of this agenda, when we're talking about the capital of the banks, their lending for infrastructure where it is needed, the reality is that is an agenda that is defined largely by middle-income countries and less so by the low-income countries in terms of volumes of finance. That has always been a hard sell politically in the United States, both explaining and even making the case for continued levels, high levels of borrowing from countries like China, from the World Bank, from the ADB, has not been an easy case to make, and particularly in the absence of any kind of strategic framework from an administration in Washington. So if there is not a clearly defined set of goals and objectives in a region like Asia, where you can see a role for the MDBs, then these are very uncomfortable questions. Why would we want to support this kind of lending to countries that otherwise themselves have deep capital markets, have ready access to other sources of financing. And I, you know, I will speak from the experience within the Obama administration. This was a hard question then too. So at the end of the day, if we speculate that the U.S. will not be ambitious when it comes to these legacy MDBs, it is my view that growth will happen elsewhere in the MDB system, and that will be led by non-U.S. actors, namely China, and the question of how China will act. Let me just briefly make a few quick comments. I think I'm using up most of my time already. So the question of, for China and the MDBs is not a question of ambition. We know that they have ambition. It is a question of relative allocations between bilateral mechanisms and the new multilateral mechanisms, and then the policies and procedures that define, frankly, both the new multilaterals, but even to some degree how the bilateral actors, namely China Development Bank and China EXIM, might be influenced by new thinking. And let me just jump to one, I think, leading example of what I mean by important policies, which is questions around sustainable financing, debt sustainability. China is not a member of the Paris Club, the club of sovereigns that get together and address problems of debt sustainability when they happen. And the broad set of norms that define particularly why how the MDBs act around question of debt sustainability remain to be tested, I think, for the new institutions. So I think it's a very important question going forward, exactly how the Chinese government wants to position itself on a question like debt sustainability, the degree to which, certainly in volumes of financing, the question is more on the side of the bilateral lenders, China Development Bank and EXIM. But it is perhaps the case that going forward, a firmer embrace by the new multilateral actors for a set of norms acting alongside peer institutions, World Bank, IMF, regional development banks, might ultimately inform a more favorable stance when it comes to sustainable lending practices, transparency around lending. Why is this in particular important? I think here let me just very quickly preview what will be some new research coming out of CGD, working on with John Hurley, who's here in the audience as well. What are the debt implications of the Belt Road Initiative? To what degree can these countries sustainably borrow for the kind of financing that is envisioned? Our very rough take, this is early work we'll be refining, but if you look at countries that we can likely define as Belt Road prospect countries, just 9 of those are at low risk of debt problems by our estimates, 7 are at medium risk, and 12 are at high risk of debt sustainability problems. It strikes to me that going heavily into this area is means inevitably that the Chinese, both bilaterally and multilaterally, will be confronting the question of debt problems in their investment agenda. And I think it will be critical, and this is just one example of an area where we will want to see them come around to a set of norms of practices that are serving us, perhaps not perfectly, but pretty well as an international community. Thanks.
Trying to find my presentation. Okay. Yeah, here it is. Thank you. Okay, so the previous speakers have already covered a lot of the grounds, so I'm going to be maybe skipping some of my prepared remarks. So I'm just going to talk about a few things. So I want to start with a brief discussion of China's approach to development finance, and as we've all heard quite a bit, the case of One Belt, One Road, I think, illustrates some of those features very well. And secondly, I want to briefly touch on China-led multilateral development, MDBs, in the region, the AIB, the NDB, which is only partially in the region, and then focus just on a short discussion of their relationship with the more traditional or legacy MDBs, and then finally the potential challenges for China's development finance and of China's development finance. Okay, so China's approach to development finance, there are two very basic principles that have been established for decades. One is mutual benefit. So unlike the OECD countries, the more traditional definition, which sees development finance and foreign aid in particular as a one-way transfer of wealth and expertise and so on, from China's point of view, development finance between Chinese and other southern countries is really about mutual benefits. So China's development finance does not only include grants, interest-free loans, concessional loans, but also export credit, non-concessional loans, many of which are resource-backed loans, and many of these arrangements actually aim to support China's going out strategy, and the Chinese are not apologetic about that. That's just by definition, mutually beneficial. And the second principle is no strings attached. And this quote from Xi Jinping in the latest summit on the One Belt, One Road emphasizes that point again. So these features make China's development finance very attractive to many, but it also potentially could cause conflict with the more traditional norms and practices of development finance. So let me say a word about One Belt, One Road. Everyone here probably has heard more than they want to about that every day and in the news. So it was proposed by Xi Jinping in 2013, and ultimately the goal is to have 65 countries involved. That would be countries host OBOR projects, and here you can see how expansive this very ambitious plan looks like on the map. And so obviously, in this case, lots of money are involved, just a few of the larger sums we have all read about. So the Silk Road Fund, $40 billion when it was established a few years ago. And then actually, over the years, 2015, for example, the government of China allocated more funds to various banks, $82 billion in 2015, and then just 2017, recently, last month, another $113 billion promised through, a few windows here. And then some of the AIB and NDB money has also gone to a One Belt, One Road project. So AIB and NDB do not completely fall under One Belt, One Road, but there is quite a bit of overlap. AIB was established in 2015, and this is a list of the projects that they approved or already started in 2016. So for that year, it was about $1.7 billion, and Scott offered more up-to-date statistics, so it has grown since then, now that 2017 is half gone. NDB also, very recent establishment, and in 2016, they came to about $1.5 billion in projects, and mostly, vast majority in renewable energy, only one in transportation for India. So speaking of the relationship of these new banks with the more traditional banks, I think it's clear. We've heard already previous speakers mentioning, so I won't get into any of these details. There is a gap. And, of course, traditional NDBs for a while kind of lost interest in infrastructure type of projects for various reasons, and they are now coming back to it, but they also have many other priorities. So, again, as Scott said before, the multilateral development banks together only contribute, just in terms of dollar amounts, a very small portion of infrastructure. So there is room for the new MDBs to come in to complement the legacy banks. And already, there is now a pretty well-recognized consensus that infrastructure is critical, and the importance of public-private partnerships in terms of funding infrastructure is also widely agreed upon. And so you've seen various initiatives, the World Bank playing a very important role in this kind of network of funders for infrastructure worldwide. And as we heard before, the World Bank and ADB both have signed separately with AIB and NDB various agreements, and specifically they have co-financed projects. AIB, the vast majority of their projects in the first year were co-financed, and NDB is talking about the possibility of doing so. Okay, so let me just end by pointing out some of the potential challenges. One challenge is the issue of environmental and social sustainability. You know, as I said before, China's approach is that no strings attached to development finance. And now that China is because of its you know, economic strength and so on, it faces very limited external pressure. And so it's not surprising that many of the mega infrastructures, One Belt, One Road, or specifically, you know, in Asia or elsewhere in the world, involving China, especially the bilaterally financed ones, tend to go through very quickly without really carefully evaluating the environmental impact. And then lack of transparency, and of course, in that process, respect of rights in countries, communities affected, is sometimes not well taken care of. And the other issue is financial sustainability. China's own infrastructure investment has been described as a feature of China's success. But a recent study by a group of Oxford scholars shows that actually much of China's own infrastructure investment has involved a lot of waste. So it wasn't as successful as one might think just by looking at the final products. And so are such things going to be repeated when China goes abroad to build infrastructure? I wouldn't be surprised if it does. And so one example is the $1.2 billion dollar seaport project in Sri Lanka, which didn't really turn out to be as profitable. And so by necessity, the Chinese took over, and that generated a lot of local protest on issues of, you know, foreign control of their national interest and so on. So those are challenges, I think, moving forward. China, as it thinks about its own development finance and others watching China, both bilaterally and multilaterally providing development finance, should keep in mind. And we already have seen a little bit of decline in the One Belt, One Road projects. Thank you very much.
Okay. All right. So, first of all, let me thank you for Milesa to invite me to such a very important event. And I'm the last person to make a presentation, so maybe the almost very important topics are already covered, I think. But so I want to stress more on the Japanese policies, the Japanese views on development lending in the Asia-Pacific regions. So, okay. All right. This chart illustrates the official financial flows to developing countries from Japan. And there is approximately $15 billion dollars of ODA, out of which $5 billion is bilateral grants, and $7 billion is bilateral loans, and $3 billion is a contribution to MDBs. And in addition to ODA, Japan, like China, you know, also provides $5 billion of the OOF, other official flows, including export credit or the other financing, which was mainly provided by the Japan Bank for International Cooperation. And this sheet summarizes the priority areas of Japan's ODA and OOF. And Japan set out the following priority issues for ODA. The first one is the quality growth and poverty reduction. The world population in poverty is still in large number, and reducing poverty, especially reducing absolute poverty, is the most fundamental development challenge. At the same time, in order to solve the poverty issues, it is essential to achieve economic growth through human resources development and infrastructure development and the growth of private sector. The next point is the building a sustainable and resilient international community. This includes the transboundary challenges such as the climate change, major natural disasters, and food issues and energy issues. As these global challenges cannot be dealt by a single country, but require united efforts by the international community. And OOF supports more like Japanese companies' business overseas, and the loans are provided on quasi-commercial conditions. The main areas of cooperation in OOF are infrastructure in Asia, natural resources, and Japanese companies' foreign direct investments. As I mentioned in the previous slide, Japan also provides ODA through MDBs. Japan is one of the largest shareholders for ADB and the second largest shareholder for the World Bank Group. Bilateral ODA and multilateral support through MDBs for Japan is a complementary relationship. And MDB has, as you might know, have a very wide range of networks and experts in specific regions or sectors. And Japan has been contributing to the activity of the MDBs not only as a major shareholder, but also providing knowledge assistance in the fields of the environment, resilience, healthcare, and human resources, or these regions. And next slide. So far I overviewed the Japan's official financial support in the previous slides. So from this page on, I want to explain quality infrastructure, which is the most recent, most important area that Japan is focusing on in the field of development finance. Quality infrastructure was proposed by Prime Minister Abe in 2015, and he committed to increase supply of financial resources from Japan toward infrastructure projects across the world at the G7 summit in Iseshima last year. He mentioned the amount is approximately $200 billion for the next 5 years, which means the $40 billion per year on average. So why Japan is focusing on infrastructure? This bar chart by McKinsey shows the expected amount of the infrastructure investment in the world. This report showed that $3.3 trillion of infrastructure projects are needed per year. And the right-hand side chart shows the 60% of the expected investment will be located in the emerging countries. And next, when you look at the in Asian regions, according to the ADB report, over $26 trillion of infrastructure projects are needed by 2030 in Asia. And that means, already quoted, I think, $1.7 trillion of infrastructure projects are needed per year. So how to secure these financing needs? Government support, MDBs, bilateral financial institutions are expected to play an important role. But I also want to stress the importance of the private financial institutions for the financing of these infrastructure investments. And this slide shows the investment flows in the ASEAN region. You can see that there are over $17 billion investment from Japan. It's a purple line. In 2015, and it is twice as large as investment from China, it's a brown line. This is because Japanese companies established their manufacturing supply chains in ASEAN countries. And the stable infrastructure, such as the power supply and the transportation, are indispensable for the manufacturing supply chains. The significance of infrastructure for manufacturing supply chains does not only apply to ASEAN region, but also all the countries where key manufacturing suppliers are located. In this slide, I summarize the key factors to be considered for the infrastructure investment. The first one is the project life cycle cost, and resilience and safety, employment and social and environmental impact, and impact on recipient countries' debt sustainability. Maybe some of the points I have already referred by the, already. I have worked in the international banking sector for over 20 years and have many experiences of the financing to an infrastructure project. In my experience, I have learned that infrastructure project takes many years for construction. And the completion of the project is not the goal, it's not the end. It's rather, it's a starting point. Infrastructure is used for many years, which requires stable and safe operations and maintenance. And the huge amount of investment cost could bring debt to the government or public entities of the recipient country. So the balance of the debt and the revenue is very important for both the investing country and recipient country. The second one is the openness of the project, as infrastructure should be open to everybody, and it's including its procurement is also should be open. An infrastructure project cannot be completed by the public entities only, and the private sector's involvement in the project and financing is inevitable. And lastly, I want to stress that the quality infrastructure is one of the key for the sustainable development goals by the improving the resilience of the country and also enhancing the people's standard of life. Okay, I am often asked, okay, so we understand the Japan's quality infrastructure policy, but does it conflict with the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative? In this regard, I don't think it is a conflicting concept, and I want to introduce the Prime Minister Abe's statement last week. I think the key message by Mr. Abe is come into harmony with the free and fair Trans-Pacific Economic Zone and contribute to the peace and prosperity of the region and the world. And this message means Japan is basically welcoming the Belt and Road Initiative, but we carefully watch whether this concept contributes to the free and fair and peaceful region. In other words, whether it is going to be a challenge to the liberal international order or not. And lastly, I want to comment on the Japan's views on AIIB. As I had explained, there is a huge amount of the infrastructure needs in the region, and in that sense, AIIB is not in the competition with the World Bank or ADB, I think. It is rather complementary to the existing MDBs. AIIB is still a newcomer, and so their number of staff and the amount of know-how are limited, and its operations are mainly co-financing with the existing MDBs. Having said that, out of the huge amount of infrastructure projects, not all projects are bankable. When AIIB starts its project formation in the future, it could become a competitor among those bankable projects. So regarding Japan's membership in AIIB, although I'm not in the position to state Japan's official views, but it is fair to say that one of the key factors will be Mr. Abe's perspective in the last slide. Also, AIIB's governance structure, such as the absence of the resident board of directors or something like that. Okay, thank you very much.
Thank you very much. So while everybody gets mic'd up, I'm going to start because time is running out, and I'm sure that there are a lot of questions from the audience. We've heard a terrific set of presentations. We have a very rich agenda to discuss. And mostly I want to get the panelists to interact with one another because I think that there were subtle differences on some important issues. And let me bring up one. the possibility that when you have several multilateral development banks operating in the region that come with different philosophies, donor approaches to economic assistance, to foreign aid, that there could be potentially a race to the bottom. And Victoria mentioned that the prospects are very low, that this is mostly a theoretical possibility. I think that Miles, for example, or Hongying perhaps thought that this possibility could have larger prospects, especially Hongying talked about China's mixed record when it comes to environmental sustainability. And I found Victoria's slide very useful because you had, the, as an example, coal. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, people talk about the AIB track record so far. There have been some energy projects, but some people mentioned that there are very few renewable energy targets in those initial projects. And the question has always been there whether China would finance coal power plants. We know that Japan, for example, has always financed coal power plants and does not believe it's a race up to the bottom because Japan argues it has technology that makes these plants very efficient. And now, of course, we know that in the United States, the future of coal has a different connotation. So I wonder if you guys could discuss whether you think that could there indeed be a race to the bottom, also because perhaps the global standard is moving because of domestic political developments within each country. How do we make sure that when we have more offerings out there, the race is to the top and not to the bottom? Anybody, any comments? Miles?
Race to the bottom can mean at least two different things. One is that everyone's standards go down. Mm-hmm. The other is if you look at the global development lending, the amount of global development, the standards overall will go down because there's a large lender that has different lenders, that has different standards, and their lending is growing very rapidly. The World Bank could still maintain its high standards, so there wouldn't be a race to the bottom, but China would be lending more and more mm-hmm. with a different set of standards. And it seems to me that's probably what most people are talking about when they're talking about a race to the bottom. It's not that the World Bank would, in response to Chinese competition, lower its standards. It's that China's lending would not meet international standards, particularly its bilateral lending. Mm-hmm. And I think that's, you know, that's the real question. And Mr. Nakajima suggested, you know, right now, many of the Chinese lending agencies are small scale. They're co-financing. But once they start to build their own projects and bankable projects are limited, they may want... There may be an incentive for them to lower their standards simply for a reason of lending more quickly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Very good, Miles. Other comments?
Victoria? Well, just to add to what's been said already, I think it also depends on the point I think you made, Scott, that it's a bilateral and a multilateral split that China brings to the table. And if it chooses to do a lot of its step up through multilaterals, or through the AIIB, for example, or through, you know, more cooperation with institutions like the World Bank on the Belt and Road, and then maybe that possibility of lower standards on Chinese investment is limited, is more limited than would ordinarily be, because AIIB standards are just like the World Bank's or the ADB's. You know, so work done through AIIB on the social environmental safeguards are similar to how we would treat them. And even the Belt and Road, you know, the government of China is looking for institutions like the... It's approached all the MDBs and signed an MOU with the MDBs to collaborate on the Belt and Road. So if the MDBs are going to be part of the Belt and Road, then again, that's another factor that would mitigate the risk of lowering standards of the Chinese step up. Mm-hmm. So just a couple of additional points.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I'll make one point and use two examples. I think certainly as a summary matter, it's not so easy to define sort of a linear path of standards where it's low standards, high standards. Mm-hmm. So two examples. So let's look at the AIIB. A lot of attention on the fact that it has a non-resident board of directors. This is a departure from most of the legacy MDBs. Some would characterize it as a weakening of oversight. On the other hand, this non-resident board has also now recruited two external members of its audit committee who were picked for their expertise on audit functions, something that doesn't exist in the legacy MDBs. The other example I would point to is to the degree that we do set the World Bank as the gold standard, the high standard, I don't think that always holds. Again, you know, these things aren't so clearly defined. So the World Bank in recent years concluded both a reform to its procurement systems and to its social and environmental safeguards. If you're looking at those from the perspective, say, of the Asian Development Bank, your view may be that they've weakened their standards. The World Bank's view is, no, we're innovating, we're trying to be more effective. The judgment doesn't hold consistently. You have different views on these things. And really, I think what's important is that you do have, particularly with new institutions, the possibility for innovation, as long as there is a commitment to underlying.
Mm-hmm.
Very small comment. AIIB is already established and it started operation, so it's an existing institution, and the Chinese map is already, it's not a hypothetical, it really exists. And how to influence the international standard to the Chinese standard? I think the inclusiveness of the China is very important. That it may be increase the dialogue with the World Bank or the other MDBs or the AIIB, or and also the maybe the U.S. or Japan or European countries' inclusiveness in the region is also very important.
Great.
Yeah, I agree with the division between multilateral versus bilateral, and I think even with the multilateral context, the Chinese policymakers have said over and over again, there's no best practice. There's perhaps better practice we can all strive for. But I have no doubt that with AIIB, NDB, China will follow most of these practices, and they don't really need to break those rules because if you compare the scale of lending, 1.7, 1.5, and here I have the three biggest state-owned banks provided a total of $225 billion in credit by the end of 2016 for the Obor project. So we're really not talking very much lending for China to do it well and according to every standard there is in the multilateral setting and do other things differently. I think for the international community, one productive thing to do is to encourage China to spend more of its resources in the multilateral setting and kind of relatively speaking reduce the bilateral action it can take with greater freedom without being watched.
And is there a way to persuade China to do that? What would be a strategy to try to persuade China to invest more multilaterally?
I think China is very interested in being welcomed and recognized, and I think really doesn't cost too much. It's really a lot of moral or just, you know, recognition that you're doing well with AIIB, continue to do so, and maybe add to the magnitude of such, then maybe that will, relatively speaking, reduce the other type of lending.
Mm-hmm. Great. So if you don't have comments on this, I'll bring in the audience. So questions from the audience. There is a microphone. If you can raise your hand, wait for the microphone, identify yourself, and ask a short, concise question. We have a lady here who has a mic.
Thank you. I'm Fei Yu from the Asian Development Bank. It's a very informative panel, and I really appreciate several speakers mentioned the importance of leveraging private sector. This seems to be the direction to go. For ADB, the current private sector operations accounts for about 15% of the total lending, and we have a goal of about 20% in 2020. And for 2030, it's going to be even bigger. So my question is, there's a trade-off between there's a trade-off that's introduced when you have more private sector capital in your lending because there's your cost of financing is tied to your credit rating, which is affected by how much exposure you have in the private sector. So for the MDBs, are we all trying to become some form of IFCs, or do we have a limit and we still primarily focus on sovereign lending versus having a small supplement of private sector lending, or do you see the other way around? I'd like to hear from the speakers. Thank you.
A very interesting question. Who would like to take it?
Well, look, I think as Scott said in his remarks, if you look globally, if you look at the OECD countries, which are the most advanced countries, infrastructure is largely public, you know, even in those countries. So, and that's a reality. I think for us as the World Bank, our sense is that, look, recognizing that the public sector is still going to be a key driver of infrastructure provision, it's also the case that there are instances where we're putting public money for infrastructure where it does not belong, or where the private sector could do it and do it better, or commercial resources could come in. And that's what we're trying to really deliberately target and do better on. So it doesn't necessarily mean that everything or the majority of it is going to be private, but we're trying to say, let's step up and take the opportunities for more commercial and private money that we haven't done in the past, recognizing that the public sector still remains very important on infrastructure provision. Yeah.
I mean, I would say, I think it's an important question, and, there's an interesting dynamic here in that if you look at the IFC within the World Bank Group, it is remarkably large today, and that is not because the shareholders decided to favor it with more capital over time. It's because it's been a profitable institution, has been able to retain its earnings and grown its capital base that way. That may be fine, and it may align with a desire to do more in the name of private sector development, but it's not so clear to me that that's sort of the result of a deliberate strategy. And I think there are some risks to this. Top of my list is crises tend to be defining events. And in the face of whether it was the global financial crisis or various regional crises, you want the public lending function of these institutions to be robust. The private function is going to be more problematic in that kind of setting, and actually can be, as we saw during the global crisis, even countercyclical in some instances. So it is not something that should be happening sort of passively, and I fear a little bit that that's some of what we're seeing.
Thank you. Barbara, you have a question? So the microphone to the other side, please. Thank you.
I'm Barbara Stalling from Brown University. I wanted to make 2 points. I don't pretend they're questions, but they can have reactions to them. The first involves sort of underlining or resurrecting a point that Mireya has tried to make twice and nobody has bitten on it. And that has to do with different philosophies of development finance from different parts of the world, specifically Western lenders and Asian lenders. Let's say for the point of argument that both want to reduce poverty as a main goal, but my view is that they go about it in quite different ways. Nowadays, and I underline nowadays because it wasn't always the case, Western donors want to attack poverty directly, lend to the poorest countries, and engage in small projects that will help immediate reduction of poverty. The Asian countries, based on their own experience, have a very different way of looking at things. Their idea is you reduce poverty indirectly by promoting growth, and their own experience says that the way you promote growth is through infrastructure. That's what they lend money for. First point. Second has to do with an interesting idea about competition among Asian donors themselves. Many people saw Prime Minister Abe's offer of $200 billion over the next 5 years as competition with the AIIB. That said or not, the more interesting piece actually is the quality infrastructure and whether this is a way of Japan, which has much more expensive projects, competing with cheaper projects in not just China, but also Korea, so that the Chinese and the Koreans build much faster and cheaper, and the Japan can't compete that way, but it's trying to compete by quality. This, I think, is a very interesting way. I'm not sure sort of how far that will go, but I would be interested in your reaction.
Thank you very much. So reactions on different philosophies and Japan's quality infrastructure concept.
May I go for the second question point, okay? Yes, you're sort of right. You know, Japanese technology is kind of very expensive compared with the Chinese one and maybe the South Korean one. But I think so. I have highlighted the life cycle cost. So infrastructure, it can be used for the longer years, 20 years or 30 years, and it is not always the cheaper infrastructure is going to be cheaper in the 20 years or 30 years time. The Japanese, I think that one of the advantages in maintenance cost in the total of the 20 or 30 years, and also including construction cost. Total cost could be cheaper for the Japanese technology. That is the key point for the quality infrastructure.
So if I can add a question to that, you know, Japan put forward the quality infrastructure project, and as Barbara was saying, many saw it as a counter to China's initiatives.
Yeah.
So I would like to ask you, Nakashima-san, what explains the different tone of last week from the Prime Minister's statement, you know, signaling cooperation, of course, still raising issues, you know, transparency of procurement, debt sustainability, something that Scott also referred to in his remarks. What explains the timing, and not just in terms of the economics of it, but the geopolitics of it, and how perhaps a new U.S. administration is affecting Japan's thinking about how it operates in the field of development lending?
Yeah, Miriam-san, you have already referred to a very important point. Last week, the Prime Minister Abe's comment was a little bit different from the former his comments. I agree with that. And I think it is inevitable that Japan cannot, ignore the China's Belt and Road Initiative. Basically, you know, the Asian region's infrastructure is a key. It's a key for not only for China but also Japan as well. So why not we cooperate, especially in the times of the U.S. is not necessarily very enthusiastic for the support in the multilateral issues. So instead of the United States, maybe Prime Minister Abe wants, you know, Japan have to or should play more leading role in that context. So I think the last week's Prime Minister Abe's comment was, I think it's a very good, comment for not only for China, but also maybe United States towards the more collaboration with China's initiative, and also introducing the Western style of the openness and fair competition style in the infrastructure project.
Any other reactions from the panel? No, if not, I'll take a question from this gentleman. I'll take two questions because we only have... If you can be super short, I'll take the three. First here, and then these two gentlemen, but very, very concise.
Hi. I was wondering if you think that there's anything in the next 5 years which is sort of completely disruptive and which, you know, could impact how infrastructure connects with other things, maybe digital or something like that, because, you talked a lot about norms, but it wasn't clear to me if you were looking at some of the positive sides of what could come together.
Okay, thank you. And these two gentlemen, the mic is coming, so if you can be concise. Thank you.
Hi, my name is Kobayashi, and I'm from JICA, Japan International Cooperation Agency, the responsible for ODA implementation. And my question goes to Dr. Kuakua. In your slide, you showed that climate change was one of the pillars for the Asian region. And Dr. Morris mentioned about the influence that the U.S. has on World Bank and multilateral banks. And I was wondering if recent moves by the Trump administration pulling out of the Paris Agreement would influence in any way your focus on climate change in the region. Thank you.
Thank you. And then the gentleman, yeah.
Yeah, Tony Lau with the Tuan Group. I have a comment and a question.
The comment super brief, if you don't mind.
Yeah, very, very brief.
Yes,
basically, I think one of the reasons why China can be a lot more flexible in their financing is because most of the money end up going back to the state-owned enterprises that do the construction, whether it's railroad, highway, you know. So it's easy, it's money from one pocket going to the other pocket. So they are much more aggressive that way. At the same time, this is my question or my second comment, is that a lot of emerging countries are limited by the non-concessional debt ceiling set by IDA. And with the concessional, with those ceiling, it limits the ability for them to finance a project through ECA, Export Credit Agency, such as Import-Export Bank. Whereas in the case of China, the Chinese Development Bank, they don't observe this debt ceiling, and therefore they keep on lending. So therefore they have a significant advantage to to the ECA financing. Therefore, my question is, from an MD perspective, do you think that do you agree that this non-concessional loan ceiling is a barrier for a lot of the emerging country? Because if you don't make the investment, you're not going to get there. My observation.
Thank you very much. Interesting observations. Responses from the panelists as we close?
Well, just on the issue of in one pocket and out the other, which was the comment rather than the question, I mean, that raises the issue of debt sustainability from the Chinese side, which Scott did not talk about. He talked about debt sustainability from the borrowing side. But there is a large debt problem in China. So yes, one pocket into another pocket, but ultimately it is debt. And someone someday may have to make up for that debt, presumably the Chinese central government. That's an issue, a larger issue for China, but this is part of that issue. And the question is whether the Chinese leadership is going to be attentive to that as well.
Very interesting.
On the question of climate change, no. I think that for us, we've issued a statement recently following the decision by the administration to pull out of the Paris deal. So we recognize the importance of the climate issues, particularly in a region like East Asia. And so our work on climate remains very central to what we're doing. We're being asked for by our clients to support them on implementing the climate agreement and their obligations to it. And we will continue to do that. We've agreed with our shareholders. Actually, our shareholders, including the U.S., have asked us to make to try and deliver climate co-benefits of at least 28% in our lending. You know, it's been agreed, and we're going to implement it. So, no, the statement doesn't change what we're committed to delivering. Now, then there was another question that I think it's directed at us to some extent on the non-concessional borrowing that some countries can do. I think it comes back to the issue of debt sustainability and whether you think that matters, you know, because if it does matter and we believe the analysis about debt sustainability for different countries, then it should have a bearing on the obligations, the debt obligations that they take on. Yes, it might be somewhat constraining in some respects, but these are it's a reality that their capacity to carry debt is somewhat limited.
Thank you. Any other short comments?
Well, and just to tie actually to the disruption point, I do think, there are certainly macro events that could be disruptive. The interest rate environment we're in now, I think, has enabled a lot, particularly in the activities of the MDBs, that could look very different in a different interest rate environment, let alone actual macro shocks. I think, the infrastructure agenda broadly is vulnerable to that. And it does get to this issue of concessional versus concessional finance.
Great.
Really quick about one pocket to another. I think let's not forget the One Road was primarily a domestic redistribution of wealth, and it now is seen as a strategy of geopolitics. And it might have become that, but that one pocket just reminds me not to forget that, and it will have serious domestic consequences.
Great. Thank you so much. We have come to the end of our time. Please join me in thanking the panelists for an amazing discussion.